Welcome to the Reformed Media Review. This is episode number 124. My name is Camden Busey, and today I plan to review Stewards of Eden, what Scripture says about the environment and why it matters. Now, this is written by Sandra L. Richter, who is the Robert H. Gundry Chair of Biblical Studies at Westmont College in Santa Barbara, California. And the book was published by IVP Academic in 2020. Now, initially, I questioned the title of this book, Stewards of Eden. Now, certainly, Adam and Eve were called to be stewards of Eden specifically, but it seems their call was to creation more generally speaking. Furthermore, our stewardship, even in this present age, should be considered eschatologically. That is, our stewardship is in service ultimately of the new heavens and the new earth, not specifically Eden, at least understood protologically. This is very basic to our love here of what we call the deeper Protestant conception, following Gerhardus Voss. And so I was really curious to read this book with a view toward eschatology. Does she present a structurally Lutheran view? Is it neo-Calvinist? I presumed it would not be anything trending toward annihilationism or a heavy form of otherworldliness, and that presumption was correct. As early as page 3 in the introduction of the book, Richter speaks against Christians who view creation as primarily bound for destruction. Such Christians might conclude that we may use the earth's resources aggressively in service of saving souls with no consideration for the long-term effects or implications of using the earth's resources in an unsustainable fashion. Now, I agree with her sentiment, yet one outstanding question for me had to do with the Lord's covenant, and specifically the covenant with creation that's described in the account of Noah and the flood. And among other things, the Lord promised that the seasons would never cease to be, Genesis 8:22. And by good and necessary consequence, it seems that mankind could never do anything so drastic as to destroy the earth, or even its regular patterns of seed time and harvest of the seasons. But is there something in between, just wanton waste and, an approach to creation that doesn't take into account any form of stewardship and the responsibility that we have? Or the idea that we may, in fact, possibly destroy the earth? Well, I think there needs to be something in the middle. Now, Richter speaks of the fall into sin, as rebellion against God. And the fall brought with it a curse, but not just any curse. It was a reversal of God's blessings. And within this context, Richter speaks of humanity's rebellion, not just in the garden, but humanity's rebellion on the garden. That's in page 13. In chapter 2, Richter begins speaking about the Old Covenant people of God and their relationship to the land as renters or lessees rather than landlords. This is a helpful mental or psychological shift that helps us understand our role in creation. And to do that, she addresses the land grant aspects of their covenant relationship to Yahweh in the book of Deuteronomy. And she then moves to a discussion of their tithing and offering practices, developing their responsibilities and dependence upon the Lord. And the Sabbath rest required in and of the land is also an indication of practices that encourage sustainable agriculture, for example, Exodus 23:10 through 12 and Leviticus 25:4 through 7. This may add dimension to the Lord's statement to the people that by abiding by these laws, they shall prolong their days in the land, Deuteronomy 5:33, 30:18, and 32:47. Now, I've typically understood that statement to refer to the Lord's allowance for them to remain there. In other words, by obeying the Lord, he would not exile them. And I think that is the primary dimension. But perhaps there is a secondary dimension, referring to the viability of the land itself. If these laws have practical application for sustainable agriculture, then the people may not be exiled because they destroyed the fruitfulness of the land. Chapter 3 is titled The Domestic Creatures Entrusted to Adam, and the author there enters into a discussion of the Sabbath and its role in organizing and, in a sense, restricting man's task. The Sabbath, you see, prevents man from becoming totally absorbed in the task of subduing creation. And this is placed within a larger discussion of the supply chain and the ethical responsibilities of producers and consumers within that economy, especially toward livestock. Old Testament law established and required a close connection between the Israelites and their livestock, particularly when it came to slaughter. They were allowed to slaughter the animals they raised, but according to Leviticus 17, they were required to consider the animal's life and bring the animal before a priest first. In support of this point, the author references Jacob Milgram, who commented that the method of slaughter in ancient Israel ensured the animal would be rendered unconscious and die a swift, humane death. Animal death always confronted the Israelites, but they were never to take it lightly. And most people today never, ever give a thought to the lives and deaths of their food. And I would venture to say that many young people might not even know that their food was alive in the first place. It's important to consider these matters and to think biblically about how to address them as Christians. But Richter doesn't just stop with domesticated animals or with our food and livestock. Richter then turns to the wild animals that God has entrusted to Adam. And responsibilities include the protection of habitat for species. She points to Deuteronomy 22, 6 through 7 as warrant for protecting native species. And it demonstrates the principle of preserving the means of life and thereby upholding sustainability. The author describes a famous Neo-Assyrian relief, which depicts a lion hunt. And this was displayed in Ashurbanipal's palace and is now on display in the British Museum. This was a piece of propaganda, but it had a backstory. For this was not the typical hunt that we might conceive. It was not a wild hunt. This relief depicts what is today called a captive hunt. The lions were trapped and then transported via a crate to a royal hunting park. And in the days before high wire fences, armed men would ensure the lion could not escape while also protecting the king from imminent danger, danger of his prey, that is. And the king would then kill the lion in order to demonstrate the qualities they sought to promote throughout the kingdom. Moreover, the Neo-Assyrians depicted their king returning from war with a mother bird and her eggs, depicting total victory, dominance, and annihilation with no concern for the region's future, in fact, seeking to eliminate it altogether. Now, God's people were never to act in this manner, even during wartime. Deuteronomy 20, verse 19, does not permit the Israelites to cut down the trees of a city or region that they are besieging. They were permitted to eat of the trees, but not to cut them down. And many of the fruit-bearing trees of the region, olive trees and date trees, for example, take as many as 20 years to reach full production, and destroying the trees in warfare would have implications for generations to come. Now, one thing I greatly appreciated is the author's skill in studying biblical examples such as these, while prompting further thought and inquiry for our own contemporary context. And overall, I enjoyed this book very much, and I believe this is an important contribution to our theological community, especially the communities that are served by publishers such as IVP Academic. But for those preferring a book that helps to connect the dots on practical matters, readers will appreciate the many case studies and the many examples that the author provides throughout its pages. But other readers may feel as I did at times, that they agree with the theological principles and the need to think critically about practical matters such as sustainable farming, even mining and pollution and all of the implications of those activities. Nonetheless, feeling that the author may have been selectively dealing with the factors and not addressing each specific issue with the nuance that it deserved. Yet I understand this is not the book for such a sustained treatment, and that Richter has researched, written, and presented in greater depth on a variety of topics in other venues. Still, other readers may experience a knee-jerk reaction to various portions of this book, but I believe that reveals a greater issue, that we might be taking our cues on creational stewardship from the political talking points and news cycles of our parties and media outlets of choice rather than from Scripture. Now, whether or not you agree with the author's conclusions on specific matters, you may just be provoked to think more deeply about your principia and why you hold your specific views on these issues, if you hold any at all. Overall, I enjoyed the work. I think people should read it if you have any interest in these topics, these matters, and the theological implications and the ethics involved. Pick it up. Again, Stewards of Eden, What Scripture Says About the Environment and Why It Matters by Sandra L. Richter, published by IVP Academic in 2020. Now, after reading this book, I now plan to branch out, to continue reading in this field as part of a larger project of my own. But the next book I plan to investigate, maybe not to review, but at least for myself to read, is Creation Care, A Biblical Theology of the Natural World, which is written by Douglas and Jonathan Moo. And I want to read that with a view toward that larger project, considering the biblical theological themes of the image of God and stewardship, heritage and the inheritance in the land, the fall into sin, and the future consummation of the new heavens and the new earth. So thanks so much for listening. We hope you listen now to our next episode of the Reformed Media Review. But until then, tolle lege, pick up and read.